You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, February 22nd, 2006. This is your host, Stephen Novella, president of the New England Skeptical Society. Joining me tonight are Perry DeAngelis.
Hello.
And Bob Novella.
Hey, everyone.
We have a special guest tonight, Terrence Hines, author of Pseudoscience and the Paranormal. He'll be joining us in just a few minutes. But first, let's start with some skeptical news items this past week. A report published in The Register, which is a British newspaper, discusses the possibility that Wi-Fi area networks, basically using radio signals to wirelessly connect computers together, that there is concerns among some people that this may be a risk factor for either leukemia or brain tumors.
This is like that cell phone nonsense.
Exactly.
And the power lines,
yeah.
Right. It's basically all part of the same basic health scare. Now, there is actually what the article is about is a university in Canada that decided to limit their Wi-Fi network on campus so that they wouldn't be exposing their students to excessive radiation. This is the name of the university is Lakehead University. All I'm saying is while the jury is out on this one, this is the president of the university, Fred Gilbert, I'm not going to put in place what is potential chronic exposure for our students. So, again, this, as you guys pointed out, this sort of radiation, it's not really radiation, it's just electromagnetic fields, concerns have been around, I think, since the early 80s. There were some early reports, some European studies suggesting that chronic exposure to high power lines may be associated with leukemia. But the bottom line is, after 20 years plus of epidemiological studies, all of the concerns have been invalidated. And in essence, there is no credible evidence that there is any health risk to chronic exposure to either high-powered lines or radio waves, or in this case, wireless computer networks. You know, sometimes it's just really hard to convince people about the lack of a health risk. You know what I mean?
Well, who was it? The president of a university that
did
this?
Yeah, the president of Canada's Lakehead University, Fred Gilbert.
I mean, this guy's the president of a university, you know?
Does it?
You got to be held accountable a little bit, for heaven's sake.
Does it make him a scientist?
I know, believe me, I know.
Well, I mean, the issues that you always run into, sort of the logical issues when you deal with these questions, is how much evidence for a lack of a health risk is enough to reassure people? Obviously, it's never 100%. You can never, ever prove zero risk. All you could do, theoretically, is just set statistical limits on how big the risk could be. But it's zero. That would require an infinite amount of evidence to say that it was zero. And the other sort of logical point is that a lot of people assume that if something is potentially risky in very, very large doses or exposures, then it's necessarily a little risky in little doses. And that's not necessarily true. For most things, there is some threshold. Now, that's true of some things, but for most things that are harmful to the body, there's some threshold of exposure where there is some biological effect. And below that threshold, there's really no measurable biological effect. But still, people are left with this sort of idea that a little bit of exposure, whether it's, again, it's a toxin or electromagnetic waves or whatever, if a lot is bad for you, then a little is a little bit bad for you, and they'd rather avoid it completely. I think part of it stems from an inherent emotional reaction that humans have. Basically, we're hardwired to avoid anything which seems tainted or noxious, and it's an evolved emotion to protect us from getting poisoned with rotten or tainted food, etc. But it just the idea of being exposed to things which are either unnatural or toxic or whatever makes us feel uncomfortable.
Yeah, but you gotta have the proper filters and critical thinking skills to, you know, go beyond these.
Right, but that requires an understanding of statistics and science and how to evaluate evidence.
Which a president of the university should have. I mean, I'm not a doctor and I don't play one on TV, but you gotta have common sense.
Yeah, well, I don't know. Maybe this guy is, you know, rose up through the humanitarian ranks and not the science sense end of academia. And he wouldn't necessarily know the first thing about how to evaluate scientific evidence.
Mm. Yeah, but it's his responsibility, though, to look before making a decision like that. I mean, look at, consult some scientists or just, you know, peruse the literature and see what it's all about. I don't think he did that if he came to that conclusion.
I wonder if there was, if somebody sold him on this or if he just did this of his own volition.
Yeah, it doesn't say.
I'd be curious to find out.
Other item of interest this week, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, which is a huge scientific organization in this country, had a meeting on last week. And during the meeting, which included a lot of teachers as well as scientists, they had essentially a rally in favor of evolution, supporting evolution and the teaching of evolution, and against attacks by creationist or intelligent design proponents on evolution. So basically they took the opportunity at their annual meeting to stand united behind evolutionary theory as legitimate science and take a stand against the evolution deniers in whatever guise they took. Which was very good. It was. I think that was a good thing to do to show support.
About time. I mean, I wish they did this.
It's not the first time scientists have basically come out and said, "Yeah, evolution is legitimate and creationism is nonsense."
Well, but this is different. I think. I mean, they really took steps. I mean, they were like running classes. I mean, how to teach it and how to deal with certain questions and things like that. I mean, this is really. Seemed much more extensive than anything I've read about.
Absolutely,
in the past,
they've definitely stepped it up. I think that this is a good thing. In the past, the difference between so-called skeptical organizations like ourselves and more mainstream, just purely scientific organizations, that scientists and scientific professional organizations have tended to ignore either controversial fringe or paranormal or pseudoscientific claims. And their thinking is that if it's not scientifically valid, it's not worth their time. And they don't want to legitimize it by paying any attention to it. And what? There's a lot of legitimacy to that point of view, because when scientists and scientific organizations spend the time to debunk these things, they could inadvertently help pseudosciences by paying attention to them. Sometimes they're better off just letting them wallow in their own anonymity. But when something like intelligent design and creationism, rises to the level that it has at the grassroots level and really is sort of threatening the teaching of evolution, which it historically definitely has hurt the teaching of evolution in this country, then scientists have to take a stand against it. They have to get involved.
Absolutely. And also, don't forget, though, it's not really just, evolution or intelligent design anymore. I mean, they're really starting to focus on things like the Big Bang and certain, astronomy and certain areas of physics. It's incredible what they're setting their sights on. And that's really scary. That scares me more than any of that. It's just like...
Absolutely.
God,
as we've discussed many times before on this show, their agenda is nothing short of changing the definition of science itself. They want science to include supernatural explanations, which it fundamentally cannot by its very nature. So I don't think it's overstating it to say that they want to destroy science as we know it. And I think the scientific community is starting to see this and take notice.
Good. About time they got off their duffs.
doesn't that make your blood boil?
Yeah, a little bit.
I just get so disgusted. I feel like just moving away.
Interestingly, the more outrageous pseudoscience and anti-science gets, the more angry it makes anybody with a brain. Basically anybody who understands science, anybody who loves science as we do, the more angry it makes us. The problem with that is that when we get angry, it makes us sound a little shrill and fanatical. And then the true believers turn around and say, oh, these guys are biased and they're, look how emotional they are. So it really works against us. No matter how angry it makes us, we have to take a deep breath and just remain as professional as possible.
It's tough. I mean, it's like talking to someone who believes the earth is flat. After a while, you're like, just get a life. Read a real book. Come on.
I mean, we know that we're outraged because of how ridiculous they are, but they make it seem like we're outraged because of how biased we are. And it's really a catch-22 that we got to watch out for. Let me give you a quote from John West, a senior fellow at the Discovery Institute. He says, "I don't understand how you can have a discussion of intelligent design if you only invite critics. That sounds like a monologue, not a discussion. I thought this was supposed to be science, not a pep rally." So again, he's trying to do the same thing. So, oh, look at these guys. They're, you know, having a pep rally. They're not allowing us into the dialogue. That just shows how biased they are. Well, you know, the fact is they don't deserve to be part of the dialogue because they're not science.
Exactly.
And they're attacking science from outside with logical fallacies, with distortions of evidence, et cetera, et cetera. So they really only deserved to be ridiculed by scientists, not made part of the dialogue. That's one of their core strategies, is to say, you know, teach the controversy, just let us into the discussion. But you know what? You don't deserve a place at the table. That's the bottom line. And in fact, letting you at the table in and of itself would hurt the discussion of science,
right?
Because it's not a science.
They don't even belong at the kids' table.
That's right. That's right.
Well stated, Bob.
Another quote by the same guy that is... The president of the Missouri-based Creation Science Association, Tom Willis, called the scientists desperate. Right. So there, that's typical political nonsense. So if the scientists unite behind evolution, they call them desperate. And if they don't do it, then they say, ah, see, support for evolution is eroding. So no matter what happens, they have something critical to say about it.
Damned if you don't.
Right. So that's just typical, you know, political nonsense. A couple more news items I want to hit before we invite our guest on the show. Now, we mentioned this before in the topic of Holocaust denial. A British historical revisionist by the name of David Irving has recently pled guilty to claiming that the Holocaust never occurred, the Jewish Holocaust of World War II. Mm-hmm. Now, in Austria, which happens to be the birthplace of Adolf Hitler, denying the Holocaust is a crime. So he pled guilty to a crime. He was sentenced to 3 years in an Austrian prison, which, you know, Irving is a pseudoscientist, a pseudo-historian. His denial of the Holocaust is pure nonsense. And
there was a specific thing in this case where he said there were no gas chambers at Auschwitz. And he actually did, in the end, he retracted that statement.
Right.
He said it was a mistake. He shouldn't have said that.
Well, but, you know, as idiotic as he is, I don't believe anyone deserves to be in prison for being an idiot. Freedom of expression and freedom of speech gives you the freedom to be wrong. And he deserves to be ridiculed, is what he deserves, not to be sitting in an Austrian prison. But the Austrians have a different idea about that than we do.
And
he ran afoul of that. Now, I think, Perry, you sent me this news item. This is an interesting one. A man who never sleeps.
Yeah.
Did you
read that?
That's
the claim in the piece, that he hasn't slept for many, many years.
I'm skeptical.
Is the claim that he cannot sleep and he has not slept, and yet he continues to function.
He's 33 years.
He's not human.
33, there you go.
I don't think you could be human and not sleep for 30 years.
Yeah, this is a Vietnam man who apparently was normal for a time, and then he had a fever. And after this bout of fever, he's had chronic insomnia and hasn't slept for about 33 years. He's now in his 60s. He says he can function, he's otherwise healthy, but he just doesn't sleep.
Is insomnia something you treat, Steve?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's, I mean, the neurologists and pulmonologists, and there are sleep specialists who treat it, but I do occasionally treat insomnia if it's part of a neurological disorder. But
the way I see this is that you've got two options here. Either it's a total hoax and this guy is just totally like, hey, I think I'll tell a cool story or whatever. So it's either that, or this guy really thinks that he's not sleeping, but he has lots of episodes of what's called micro sleep,
right?
And if you force yourself to stay awake for extended periods of time, you'll experience bouts of microsleep, where you actually are asleep for just moments or seconds, and that kind of like that kind of gets you through it. I mean, it's not a deep, sustaining sleep, but it kind of helps a little bit. So this guy, maybe he's having, you know, all these different episodes of microsleep, and he's really kind of not aware that he's having them.
Right.
And that's how he's kind of remained alive. I mean, because I think you will literally go insane if you don't get REM sleep or any type of sleep.
His wife says that even liquor can't put him down.
Right.
According to the piece.
Now, people with quote-unquote insomnia do sleep. I mean, they have trouble falling asleep. They have disturbed sleep. They may wake early. They may only sleep for an hour or two or three at snatches, and then they are usually sleepy during the day, and they will have brief naps during the day. So even people with severe insomnia do sleep. Insomnia doesn't mean that you go completely and utterly without sleep. But that is not the claim here. I guess it's possible that this news account is very inaccurate. And that maybe this guy's had insomnia for 33 years, but he's not completely sleepless. What they're suggesting in the article, Bob, which I guess you have to list as a third possibility, as remote as it is that this guy's brain has been altered in some way, and
no.
He actually can't sleep. I mean, he actually doesn't need sleep the way that normal people do. That is a rather extraordinary claim. I absolutely would be very, very skeptical of that.
I don't even consider it an option. It's just, I mean, you'd have to reorganize your brain to get by without sleep.
It's
it's not like a simple little, you know, chemical change or simple little. I mean, I think it would be a significant,
right.
You know,
well,
update
to
your brain.
You could. It wouldn't be difficult to you know, damage a part of the brain that then would make it difficult or impossible for you to enter your sleep cycle. It might make it difficult for you to have to go through normal sleep, but it wouldn't make you impervious to the effects of not sleeping.
Yes,
that's much
exactly.
More of a inherent process. It's more of a biochemical process of the brain. What happens when we don't sleep is that while we're awake, you know, certain chemicals build up in our brain,
right.
And then we can only get rid of them during sleep. There's also
right.
There's a host of, you know, neurological processes that are necessary during sleep, and if we don't get them, all kinds of bad stuff happens to our brain. We do eventually become psychotic, which is what you meant by going crazy, and start to hallucinate, et cetera, et cetera. So the
right.
brain just cannot function without sleep. So the story can't be accurate. I mean, we'll look further into it if we can drag anything else up. I couldn't
right.
find anything else on it to get into more detail in this article. And there's
nothing
published in the scientific literature on this. So far, it's just more of a superficial sort
right.
of lay news report. But
although I have thought about what it would be like if when we eventually do what I believe eventually we'll do away with sleep in one way or the other. Who knows how long it's going to take. But, I mean, as much as I love sleep and love sleeping, it's just such a colossal waste of time. And I just imagine what you'd be able to get done.
A third of your life. A third of your life is wasted.
A third of your life. If you live to be 100, you've spent 25 to 30 years in bed. I mean, to me, it's such a huge waste
right.
of time. And look what this guy did. What, he dug two ponds or something in his spare time at night when everyone's asleep. I mean, imagine you can get the equivalent of university degrees. You could
right.
read. Think of all the reading you could do if you didn't have to sleep at night.
I don't know if that one is solvable, at least by extrapolating from current technology. I mean, I have to.
No,
it takes some fundamental new technologies.
Right.
I think before we could achieve that.
Right.
But.
The article I read said that you'd have to in one sense reorganize the brain in
right.
order to allow that to happen, and yeah, it would be a colossal, unbelievable thing. But I mean, I think eventually
yeah.
We'll be able to do something.
It's hard
like
to
that.
Argue I mean, with eventually, because it could be
well,
pretty
yeah,
open ended.
Exactly. I mean, Steve, we're not. I mean, I'm not proposing breaking any laws of physics.
No, I know.
Here. Just,
I know.
I mean,
I'm just
eventually,
saying.
Eventually, our brains are just. We're just going to completely computerize our brains into really
yep.
fast and hardy software and hardware.
As long as you're not violating laws of nature, it's you know, it's hard to make the argument that something will never happen. Never's a long time.
Bob is a firm believer in the coming of the superhuman. He is.
Dude, it's coming.
It's
inevitable.
Well,
one
last quick item. I thought we would go from the man who never sleeps to the boy who never eats or drinks. You guys
right.
remember Buddha
right.
Boy.
That's what this
right.
reminded me of.
Buddha Boy, we talked about, I think, in the November or December episode. He is a 15-year-old who apparently has been meditating under a tree for 6 months, has not eaten or drinking by local accounts for 6 months.
Which, drinking?
Or drinking. He has no water.
Or drank. But, yeah, of course not. Now, are they still closing the curtain every night?
Apparently. Now, several months ago, scientists promised that they would examine these claims. And I searched and searched to see if there was any concrete result from such examinations, and there's nothing. But there is a new news report. I did find an update from just a few days ago that the Buddha boy is still at it, although locals claim that he is starting to look a bit weary and tired. But he's still alive, apparently.
He upped the ante here, it looks like.
He had an episode of spontaneous combustion where
oh, good heavens.
The clothes burned off his body without leaving any scars. And we are promised a video of this, although it has not yet been released. But, you know, famous last word.
Doesn't spontaneous combustion usually involve the body?
Yeah, yes.
I never recall a story of just the clothes.
That's spontaneous human combustion.
Oh, I'm sorry. This is spontaneous clothing.
Yes,
combustion.
Apparently.
I got it. I was not aware of this phenomenon.
Perry, it's called sartorial combustion.
Spontaneous sartorial combustion.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
All right. I just coined that.
It's wonderful.
We'll make sure you get credit for that, Bob.
What's that?
We'll make sure you get full credit for coining that term.
Okay.
So there you go. He's burning his clothes off his body. I wonder.
We'll keep an eye out for the video materializes.
The alleged video, the alleged scientific investigation. Yeah, if anything actual concrete comes to this. Now, the report did make me wonder if all of the actual amount of attention that this kid is getting is starting to work against him a little bit. Maybe it's getting harder for him to sneak food and water, and he actually is starting to feel it. Because, by eyewitness reports, he looks weakened.
How hard could it be to close the curtain?
I don't know.
But Steve, after 9 months, does he still have crowds? How big are the crowds now?
Apparently, many people, stay with him.
Yeah. Wow.
And if there's somebody out there who wants to make a hefty donation to the nest, we'll be glad to take a trip out there.
If we anyone wants to fund our trip to Nepal,
we'll take it there. We'll go and
we could tape. We could record the podcast at the tree with the kid
live from Nepal.
Live.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay. Well, let's go to our guest. Well, joining us now is Terrence Hines. Terry, welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
I'm glad to be here.
Hey, Terry.
So, Dr.
Hi, how you doing?
Dr. Hines
Good,
is a PhD in experimental psychology at Pace University. He is the author of the book Pseudoscience and the Paranormal, A Critical Examination of the Evidence, which is now in its second edition. And he is the author of many articles he has been published frequently in the Skeptical Inquirer. He also lectures extensively on the paranormal and has, in fact, given a couple of lectures for our own group, the New England Skeptical Society. So again, Terry, thanks for joining us. It's always a pleasure to have fellow skeptics on the show.
Glad to be here.
Now, I cleared this with you before we started recording, but I told you about our segment, Science or Fiction.
Mm-hmm.
Again, for the audience, every week I come up with three science news items, and two are real, one I made up, and I challenge my panel of skeptics to figure out which one is fake, and Terry graciously agreed to play along this week.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
So I'm going to read the three items. We occasionally have a theme to the items. The theme, this is a loose theme, but the theme this week is primate psychology, which I thought would be down your alley.
Okay.
Terry, I am going to ask you to go last. I want Bob and Perry to give their answers first, and then I'll let you go last because I think this might be a little, I'm not sure this is going to be as challenging for you as it is for them. Okay, so here are the three items. And don't say anything until I read all three items, and I'm going to go one by one. Item number one, recent psychology experiments show that people make better decisions with their subconscious mind than their conscious mind. Item number two, recent discoveries of Neanderthal man cave paintings finally established that these primitive, quote-unquote, cavemen had a culture of art. And item number three, a host of recent research indicates that the great apes have complex culture, including fads and fashions. Bob, why don't you go first?
First? Okay. Let's see. People make better decisions subconsciously than consciously.
That's number one, yes.
Well, that seems terribly vague. I mean, there are certain things that you can do better subconsciously because you're not... Because if you try to think how you do it, you're just kind of like, you know, paralysis by analysis. You can't really think about it. You just got to kind of just do it. So that makes sense to me, but it's so ambiguous, it's hard to make a good decision. The second one, cave paintings, culture of art. I mean, that seems totally plausible to me. There's been so many paintings found, so many cave paintings, and how many were never found or were destroyed or just deteriorated. I mean, there could have been hundreds or thousands of them. I could see how that could be defined as a culture of art in a sense. I mean, maybe back then people walked from cave to cave and checked out art. I don't know. Let's see.
Just to be specific about it, that means that there was an identifiable style. That you could see that, you know, two different works of cave paintings actually had similar technique and style.
So that's what you meant by culture of art.
Yes.
Okay, that sounds plausible as well. Sure. That sounds... I can't think of anything to make that seem plausible.
And number three...
Let's see, fads and fashions in...
In the Great
in,
Apes.
In the Great Apes. Fads or fashions... That seems least plausible to me. There's no fads in clothing because they don't.
Yeah,
have
definitely
any
not anymore. Referring to clothing, but behavior. I'm obviously referring to behavior.
Right. Fads or fashions. I mean that's not completely out there either. But I'll go with that.
Okay. So Bob's going number three is fake. Perry, what do you think?
Well, I think Bob spewed
Perry,
out everything I was thinking. Perry, with a P like Paul. I think Bob spewed out everything. I'll just go along with him. I think it's number three.
Okay. Terry, you going to straighten these guys out?
Well, I read the article of number one today.
I figured you would have read some of these because they were plastered over a lot of the science websites. But
yeah. And number two, it certainly sounds plausible when you redefined it as a kind of identifiable style. So I'll go with the number three being the fake.
Okay, so you all say number three is the fake. Well, let's start with number one. Terry already let the cat out of the bag. So yes, there was a series of experiments which demonstrate basically what they did is they had, you know, they always use college students as the guinea pigs in these studies. They gave them a certain, you know, choice they had to make between items, and then in one group they forced them to decide what they wanted while they were, you know, being actively presented with that choice. In the second group, they had them do a distracting task for 15 or 20 minutes and then quickly decide without further deliberation. The group that had this sort of 20 minutes of distraction were more happy with their decision in the long term than the people who had to make their choice while they were actively thinking about it.
Yeah. But there was an interaction between the amount of information they had to base their decision on. If you had just a few bits of information, then conscious was better than unconscious. When you were kind of overwhelmed, unconscious was better than conscious.
Exactly. So the thinking is that there was time to sort of subconsciously process this information and look for whatever, some patterns or things that might actually lead you to a better decision. And that when people get overwhelmed with a lot of details, they may react to one or two details and not really make a better overall decision. So interesting, you know, obviously very narrow in how the study was actually done, but that is sort of the implication that we do some actual useful processing of information on a subconscious level. Number two is actually incorrect. I always try to make them sound plausible, but there's a couple of details in this that make it wrong. First of all, I said Neanderthal man. Cro-Magnon man had cave paintings and cave definitely painting, had a, yeah, had a tradition, yeah, a style.
Did you say Neanderthal?
Neanderthal.
Playback. He did.
I did say Neanderthal. I always read it right in front of me because so I don't make mistakes. So, but the thinking was that I thought you guys were going to err the other way because Neanderthal man, the common belief is that Neanderthal man had no art, and in fact that's not true.
Right.
They've discovered many pieces of clear pieces of art that are found with Neanderthal remains. But here's the difference. First of all, no cave paintings. They're all stone sculptures. The second thing is that they all appear to be one-offs. In other words, an isolated single piece of art. There's never any style or tradition or culture of art. So the idea is that, yes, sure, the over the thousands of years, you know, there may have been the occasional Da Vinci among Neanderthal men who, you know, saw a stone and, you know, vaguely recognized a human face in there and then modified it to look more human. But there was no tradition or culture of art where a style or techniques were passed down or were done in a repetitive way. So there was no repetition of artistic style or pieces among Neanderthal men, only among Cro-Magnon men. But they did have art.
I wonder if that's...
Go ahead.
That's interesting. I wonder if that's because cave paintings are just more long-lasting than pottery. And so there's less of a database in the Neanderthal pottery than there is.
Well,
this is
not pottery among Neanderthal men. It's stone.
Stones. Carvings or whatever.
But actually, the stones I think are more durable than cave paintings. These are rocks.
Yeah.
These are, you know, and
I see.
One piece of art, for example, it was basically a rock that was, I think, it was about 14 or 15 inches across that looked like a stylized face. In fact, it could be either human or it could have been meant to be feline. And a tooth had been inserted through the rock. It's very interesting, so that the two halves, like if you put the tooth through the nose, through the bridge of the nose, so that the two halves of the tooth look like eyes. And they were able to show through analysis that the stone was worked. It wasn't just didn't naturally look that way, and that the tooth was deliberately inserted where it was, so it couldn't have been an accident. And it's an interesting looking, you know, piece of art, but again, it's an isolated thing. That technique has never been seen anywhere else. Again, no culture of art. Number three is absolutely true. There have been numerous now researchers who are documenting that all of the great ape species can pass on culture. And troops of whether they're gorillas or chimpanzees or whatever will in fact, you know, use the same techniques, you know, have the same behavior, and that behavior will be unique to that troop, and they pass it down from parents to children. So that's culture; it's knowledge that they pass down.
Mm-hmm.
And they've even observed now only among chimpanzees, which are our closest relatives, so it makes sense. They've actually observed very peculiar behavior that seems to last for a short period of time and then goes away, so-called fads.
Right.
In other words, young chimpanzees, interestingly only among the children, were for a while were doing this hand-flapping behavior, which they found humorous. And they were sort of doing that behavior and passing it around for a while, and then it just sort of faded out and they stopped doing it. So,
wow.
Interesting.
Yeah, what threw me off with the fads and fashions.
Well, that term from the article that I referenced. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, if you just said behaviors.
Well, I thought I clarified that, but you're right. I mean, it does.
No, but you know, but just those two words really kind of put you in a mindset I don't know.
It's anthropomorphizing. You know, it's those terms. You think of them in terms of human behavior, but maybe there is no fundamental difference between, you know, the behavior that they're observing among chimpanzees and why, you know, people will start to use certain phrases or do certain behaviors. It'll become popular for a while, everyone will do it, and then it'll fade away. You know, it's the same, basically the same pattern of behavior that they're observing.
Shadows of Forgotten Ancestors.
Absolutely. Great book, by the way, by Carl Sagan. You know, trying to learn about human behavior by observing our closest primate ancestors. Anyway, you guys, you know, your analyses were all correct. This was a tough one.
Stumped us.
I got all of you.
That's all.
Terry, thanks for playing.
Oh, you're welcome.
So,
Do I win somebody's voice on my? Did I? If I got it right, would we win somebody's voice on our answering?
You
machine?
Win my voice on your answering machine, for whatever that's worth.
Yeah.
So I was looking through a lot of the articles and stuff that you've written, just to come up with some ideas to what to talk about tonight. Actually, one thing caught my attention. In your book, you write about lie detector tests. And basically arguing that, you know, it's no different than a coin flip, and, you know, research has shown that if you even subtly bias the examiner, the person performing the lie detector test, by suggesting this is the guy we're interested in, for example, that mm-hmm. that utterly biases the outcome of the lie detector test. Have you seen, however, the recent fMRI studies,
yeah,
which purport to be a very accurate lie detector test, basically looking at...
Yeah, they're not,
go ahead.
They're not only fMRIs, but there's some evoked potential studies. I think it's a P400 study. I've seen some of those. They seem promising.
Yeah.
They seem promising.
There's nothing wrong in principle with the idea that, you know, when we lie, something is different is happening in our brain than when we tell the mm-hmm. truth. The classic lie detector uses physiological measurements, sweating
right.
and whatnot, which people can learn to fake or fool. But this is looking directly at brain function, and it's very hard, mm-hmm. it's very hard to influence how your brain works. In fact,
and
it's probably impossible. So,
I mean, isn't it conceivable that they might eventually, you know, come out with a really portable device that you can even use at a distance?
MRI scan?
Probably not at a distance.
Yeah.
I can't imagine at a distance.
Even, you know, maybe 10 or 20 feet. I mean, kind of like you're not really where you're not aware that you're being tested in such a way. Is that possible?
Not with current technology.
No, because, I mean, you really, to measure either electrophysiological signals from the brain or blood flow, you've got to have a device attached to the head.
Right.
Okay.
And those signals drop off, obviously, with the inverse square law.
They drop off very quickly.
Yeah.
Very quickly.
Okay.
The same reason why ESP doesn't work, basically.
That's right.
The skull attenuates those signals tremendously, so you have to be pretty close to the head to get a good recording.
Right.
Oh, God, what do you think will happen if they can actually show that this thing is a really reliable lie detector? Say, say 95-99%, which is conceivable from what I've read about it.
Sure.
It seems conceivable that this can be extremely accurate. I mean, can you imagine the effect it might have on
jurisprudence?
Law? Can you imagine that? And they allow it in courts?
Criminals, spies.
Yeah.
Yeah, think about it. The implications are huge.
Yeah, sure.
Wow.
It reminds me of the lecture you gave to us, I think it was last year, about, I can't remember what the name of this effect is, but the idea that if you understand how to read a language, you can't...
Oh, the Stroop effect.
The Stroop effect, right. You can't suppress it, and that was used to sniff out spies who were pretending like not to speak Russian.
That's right. That was a legend. I've never been able to get anybody at CIA to confirm
that, but
that's a legend.
Is that right? Any update on that? I mean, you had talked to us about the fact that for the first time, you apparently had discovered that people were able to suppress the Stroop effect through hypnosis, and that they might have actual a different hardwiring in their brain where they can suppress reality.
I hadn't discovered that. Amir Raz at Columbia had discovered that. And he also showed, and I'm working with Amir on some related projects, but he also has shown that when they're hypnotized, the brain areas, certain brain areas are in the hypnotized, the highly hypnotizable people are in fact turned off, reduce activity, I shouldn't say turn off, to grandiose.
Right. So these people may have, just because they're, you know, mutants or whatever, they have altered brain biology, they're able to actually suppress certain parts of their brain that most people cannot suppress,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
and that this may actually alter their perception of reality.
Yeah, only when they're highly hypnotized.
Right.
Apparently only when they're hypnotized. Although I've heard that Amir just published a paper I haven't seen that suggests that for highly hypnotizable people, even when they're just given suggestion but not hypnotized per se, they show some reduction in the Stroop effect. I have to dig that paper
right.
out.
Of course, what is hypnotism, right? I mean, it's not really no real operational definition of what hypnotism is there? I mean, it's basically just a highly suggestible state.
Suggestible state, right.
Mm-hmm.
So it's probably just a spectrum of suggestibility, not...
Well, certainly that's right. All the scales of hypnotizability show that ability to be hypnotized is normally distributed just like height and weight and, you know, those other things.
And at the extreme end, people can actually suppress parts of their brain that are... What are the parts of the brain that they're suppressing usually?
Well, in the Stroop study, they're suppressing a part of the brain called the word form area, which if you look at a little word, just print it on a page, this word form area becomes active. If you look at a nonsense string of letters, the word form area becomes active. If you look at a string of letter-like but not letter symbols, the word form area becomes active. And that's the area that's being, it's not as active in these folks when they're hypnotized. Somebody else's study, and I've forgotten whose it is, shows a similar phenomena for placebo effects. People who are highly suggestible, et cetera, show a heightened placebo effect for pain, and when they're scanned, the somatosensory areas that respond to pain show reduced activity, but that reduced activity correlates with an area in dorsal lateral prefrontal cortex, a part of the brain that we think of as involved in decision making and conscious processing. That area shows a heightened activity.
I see. So basically, like, the more evolutionarily higher levels of the frontal cortex are more active, and they are either suppressing or taking over for some more primitive areas that experience pain, basically.
Yeah, that respond to letters and such.
Right.
It would be interesting to know if there are different sets of connections between the highly hypnotizable people and the less hypnotizable people. And there's a technique out there that now can do that without having to, you know, wait for folks to die and cut up their brain.
Yeah.
It's called diffusion tensor imaging, which allows you to look at white matter tracks in the brain, in a living person.
Right.
Do you think being highly hypnotizable would make you more fantasy prone?
Absolutely, it does. That's absolutely true.
Yeah.
That's the big interest for us as skeptics, is that a lot of these are the people who are generating many of the ghost, you know, witnesses phenomenon and a lot of the paranormal phenomenon. When you start to look at the people who see ghosts and, you know, have these experiences, they tend to be highly fantasy prone, highly hypnotizable, highly suggestible, and maybe they actually have a different, we're looking at a subset of humanity that has a different, you know, brain organization that enables them to consciously suppress more automatic parts of their brain.
Mm-hmm. And I also think that they are better, not better, but they see patterns, they're more likely to see patterns where there are none.
Right.
Wow.
And
if you
see patterns where there are none, then you have to explain at least to yourself why the patterns are there. But if the patterns aren't really there, any explanation you come up with is going to be bogus by definition.
Right.
Right. Kind of like a hyperpareidolia.
Right.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. Pareidolia being seeing objects in random stimuli, like face in the clouds, is pareidolia.
Right. And there's a researcher in Switzerland whose name I'm embarrassed to say I have forgotten at the moment, who's been doing some very interesting work showing that basically this pattern, as you'd expect, this pattern recognition stuff kind of comes out of the right hemisphere.
Yes.
And he's done some work, and I haven't read this recently, so I'm kind of pulling it out of what passes from my long-term memory. But my impression of my memory is that he's shown that if you give normal people drugs that enhance dopamine function, give them a little bit of L-DOPA, basically, they're people who are initially quote-unquote normal now start to see more patterns. And if you let the L-DOPA wear off, they see less patterns.
Right.
They go back to normal.
Right.
Wow.
And he suggested that these people I think he's at least hypothesized that people who are highly likely to see patterns where there aren't any have a mildly hyperactive dopamine system, and we know that schizophrenics, at least in part of their pathologies, is a way overactive dopamine system, and they tend to hallucinate. It's a very interesting series of studies he's done. That are, I think, quite profound.
Yeah, I think, obviously, I'm a neurologist, for those in the audience who may not have heard that before, and I'm fascinated with the way our brains construct reality for us and what role that plays in belief in the paranormal, basically, and also our beliefs in anything, how we know what's real and what's not real. It's very interesting to think that, you know, there's specific parts of the brain that allow us to distinguish reality from unreality, to test reality, to gauge the probability of our own experiences. There are also parts of our brain that allow us to see patterns, and that's a very adaptive, necessary function. But anything that's adaptive and necessary, if it over functions, can start to become a detriment. Whether it's you know, again, the ability to think creatively is good, but when when that's overactive, maybe that unhinges us from reality. The ability to see patterns is critical, but if that becomes overactive, then we start to see patterns that don't exist. And again, I think we're just dealing with the people at one end of the bell curve of the variations in these neurological abilities that tend to see things and believe things that aren't real.
I think many people yet do not quite grasp just, you know, how immensely important the biology of the brain is into how you perceive the world around you.
Right.
It's so critical, you know, that things are working properly up there.
I know. And when you talk to true believers, they are definitely coming from this premise, this assumption that our brains function perfectly, that there are no gives and takes in how our brain works, and that if they experience something, it was real, and if people believe something or if they say something, well, why would they possibly lie, and they had that experience, and we have to believe that. Wrong. Our brains are completely messy, unreliable, you know, sacks of meat, and we have to have a very nuanced understanding of how they work. In fact, 90% of science is just correcting for the imperfections in our brain. You know, it's basically trying to eliminate deception, whether it's self-deception or other deception. It's definitely understanding of this part of the brain, this aspect of our own brains, is definitely something that separates the skeptics from the true believers. I think it's very, very important.
Yeah, an interesting point in that regard is the wonderful new book by Susan Clancy, Abducted, how people come to believe they were kidnapped by aliens. Mm-hmm. It's published by Harvard University Press, and it's a book. It's not a technical book, and I actually just reviewed it in the current Skeptical Inquirer. It's really a masterpiece, and she makes this point so eloquently that these people who really believe and really remember, in some sense, that they've been kidnapped by aliens, they're not crazy, they're not stupid, they're not on drugs, but they have had these experiences, and then they've been reinforced by alien cult and so forth. But she goes through the processes to create one of these false memories and with such grace. And then it's interesting to go online to Amazon.com and look at the online reviews. 75% of them are very complimentary, and 25% of them are from the true believers who say she just doesn't understand that you know, belief determines reality, and if she doesn't believe, then it won't happen to her. My cousin Bernie believes, and so it really happened to him, and so forth and so on.
Which, by the way, is exactly what you find if you go onto Amazon.com and read the reviews of your book, which I did today. And there's most of them, 75%, are very complimentary. And
Out of the 14 or 15 that are on there, it's like, let's see, 12 or 13 are 5 stars, 5 out of 5. There's 1 4 star, and there's 2 1 stars.
Both true believers. Both obviously true believers.
1 stars, and I got some quotes here for you, Terry. So let's see. This one guy says, turning to parapsychology, Hines gives a partial, selective, and biased review of the voluminous research on this topic. I've got a little more here. Let's see. He selects one of the arch critics, Hyman, who's notorious for giving erroneous critiques, as his spokesperson. It would not be so bad if there was also a balanced presentation of the research, but there is not. Virtually none of the many meta-analyses that have found such surprisingly positive results for both clairvoyance and psychokinesis are mentioned. And then so he goes on there, and then he says something funny. It struck me as funny. Hines gives some appropriately devastating critiques of some of the pseudosciences. Unfortunately, the book cannot be counted as trustworthy. Now, of course, pseudosciences to this guy, you know.
Except for what he believes.
Except for his pet little beliefs.
Right.
Then they're not devastating. Then they're like, oh, my God, how dare you not include these, you know, analyses. I mean, it's pretty funny.
But it's funny you mentioned that about your book, because that's what you'll find about any skeptical book is going to have that.
Yes.
Terry, how would you – I know it's difficult to do, but how would you define pseudoscience?
You're right. It's difficult.
demarcation problem. But go ahead.
Yeah.
Give it a
shot. when I was doing my defense of my doctoral dissertation. My doctoral dissertation was on nothing related to pseudoscience. It was on how bilingual memory is organized. And one of my committee members was from the linguistics department. And she asked me, and she was a young professor at the time. And she asked me, how do you define bilingualism? And I looked at her, and Mike Poser, my advisor, kind of gave her this glare. And Mike just cut in, and he said, you know, definitional questions are almost impossible to answer. Mm-hmm. And so, and I, you know, you have a set of criteria, which is different than a definition. You apply a set of criteria, and you come up from that set of criteria with some measure, some metric of how likely this belief is to be a pseudoscience.
Right.
A definition you think of as something like a one or two sentence thing, and it just can't be done.
I bet Webster did it.
Yeah, but he didn't do it very well.
Yeah.
No, that's right, that's right.
No, you're right. I mean, you have to write articles. I mean, I wrote an entire article on what's the difference between science and pseudoscience, and people have written books about it. I mean, that's really what it takes. You can't boil it down. It's not black and white. It's not like things are completely science or completely pseudoscience. It's a spectrum, and you could be anywhere along that spectrum, somewhere in the middle, you know, basically science or basically pseudoscience. And it just depends upon how many of these 20 or 30 or how many you can come up with criteria you have that either put you in one category or the other. But I do think, having thought about this a lot, I do think that, yes, there's this spectrum, and you could be anywhere along the spectrum theoretically, but in our experience, things tend to lump towards one end or the other. I do think there's what we call a bimodal distribution. If you basically are a scientist, you're going to try to do everything correctly. And if you have some other agenda other than following the truth wherever it leads you, you're going to commit a host of fallacies in order to maintain your belief. So in our experience, most things either clump towards one end or the other of the spectrum. You seem to agree with that.
I do. Yeah, I do agree completely.
And then occasionally you have the true controversial thing that sort of falls somewhere in the middle. We've been talking about the brain. I wanted to move to the other end of the body and follow up on a very interesting article you wrote. You probably know what I'm going to talk about the G-spot.
Oh.
You wrote an article called The G-Spot, A Modern Gynecological Myth, where you basically, through your pathological evidence and other lines of evidence, say that there really is nothing to support the existence of a special location, you know, within, you know, the female genitals that have any more neurological innervation or more responsiveness than any place else. So this is basically a myth. Now, a lot of the stuff that's written about your article on the web is very critical of it. I went to a web.
Oh, isn't it? I've been called gay and impotent, and I'm neither, by the way.
And I went to, there's a website that's actually called drgspot.net, who had a very critical review of your article. But this is a few years ago that you published this. Is there any update on this? Was this a one shot deal for you, or have you?
Well, it was a one shot deal. I was hoping it would turn into something more. I'd started the article just because a student of mine in a neurophysiology class I was teaching one semester here at Pace, she had also been taking the sex course that we teach in the psych department, and her sex textbook talked about the G-spot as if it was real, and she asked me one day, Dr. Hines, is the G-spot real? And I said to her, well, you know, it must be. I mean, everybody talks about it. And then I figured I'd do a little online research, because obviously if everybody talks about it, there must be, if the claim is that there's this particular anatomic location on the interior vaginal wall that's really more sensitive and somehow directly tuned into higher spinal and brain centers that induce orgasm, then there, by any reasonable anatomical definition, there must be lots and lots and lots of nerve endings there and fewer elsewhere.
Right.
And nerve endings are real easy to see under the microscope. I mean, you know, any first-year biology student can do it. So I figured there must be lots of studies out there where they've, you know, looked at autopsy tissue, surgical specimens, and found lots of Meister's corpuscles or free nerve endings or whatever the hell they're going to be. And there was nothing. There's nothing out there. There are a number of people who had, in fact, done histological analyses of the vaginal wall and found that there are nerve endings there, as you would expect, and there may be a difference between the anterior to the superior third and the inferior two-thirds because they come from different embryological sources. But I couldn't find any specific finding that there was this clump of neurons. And granted, nobody had specifically looked for them. But it's kind of like saying, somebody claiming there's an island in New York Harbor that's not on any of the maps. And then you go and you look at all the maps, and in fact it's not there. But if it's an island, somebody would have run into it.
Right.
So I wrote this article just basically saying, you know, there's no histological evidence. There's behavioral evidence, but when you look at that, it's all highly subjective. Surveys asking women if they have a G-spot,
right,
and some percentage say yes. The only kind of experimental evidence came from, I think, a study of a total of 12 women who were enrolled in the study, to find the G spot, and they had the experimenter who basically this is a family show, I gather. Manually stimulated the anterior vaginal wall, and some percentage of these women, like 80%, had an orgasm. Well, you know, this is not exactly a double-blind study here.
They
knew why they were there. They were probably self-selected to be responsive. And I'm sure the orgasms are very real. You know, it's hard to say this in a family way, but stimulation in that area is bound to be pleasurable.
Right.
And you don't need a specific, you know, somebody once said that the most erogenous organ is the one between the ears. And if a pervasive sociological belief was that stroking the earlobes, that the earlobes were in a erogenous zone, there would be some significant number of people who would respond sexually to stroking the earlobes. And we actually have a name for those people. They're called Ferengi.
That's right.
It's a really, really obscure Star Trek joke there.
You can
edit it out if you want. But what happened is I got vilified. I mean, really, the messenger bringing the bad news. But at this, I said, there's a website out there. I don't know if it's still there. It says, you know, I'm impotent and I don't know how to please women. And I don't know that it said I'm gay, which I don't know how you.
You are sanitary.
Well, that's true, but I wasn't. I have a kid.
And for the record, you are willing to prove to any young, attractive women that you are not gay or impotent, just for the record. Right.
And in fact, after the paper came, the paper was published August 28th, 2001, and I think there would have been a lot more. I think it would have been a cause celeb nationwide if September 11th hadn't tragically happened. Because after that, obviously, people had a whole lot more important things to worry about.
Absolutely.
But I did get letters, and I have my nut file. Most skeptics have. Women saying, I've got one and I'll prove it to you.
Mm-hmm.
Had it not been for September 11th, and I would have written back and say, send me a picture first.
Right.
But then there's this guy who wrote, it may be the Dr. G-Spot guy, who I've forgotten the details of his study. I don't think he had ever published it. One of the other issues was this female ejaculation issue.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of took no position on exactly what that was about, but since I mentioned the article, people criticized me for denying it. And I think what it is urine with a lot of various exudates in it. But anyway, this guy had done this study where he claimed that he could show that during orgasm, females, in fact, ejaculated a substance, a fluid that was released from the urethra, a fluid that was different from urine. And the way he did this, he catheterized them,
mm-hmm.
and then somehow brought them to orgasm. Now, I have never been, and I hope never to be, catheterized.
Mm-hmm.
But it is I have seen it done. I know what it's about. I can think of, unless I was really into S&M, which I'm not either that, I can think of almost no situation would be less sexually attractive than having a Foley put up there,
right.
Male or female.
Right.
I've been catheterized. It was not
it's
stimulating
kind of
in any way.
It's a very artificial experimental situation that doesn't reflect reality, probably. But let me ask you a couple of follow-up questions that occurred.
Okay.
Is the belief in the G-spot cultural? Do we know that?
We don't know that, but I think it is. I think it is interesting that the G-spot emerges in the American sexology literature in 1950 or 49, one or the other.
Right.
The Indians, the East Asians who had the Kama Sutra, to my knowledge, it's never mentioned in any of those ancient texts, which are pretty right on about everything else they got. They got that right. And so, I mean, did they miss it? And I think the answer is no. And in fact, it was created by this guy named Grafting.
Mm-hmm.
Grafenberg, whatever. And if you actually go back and read his original paper, he doesn't really talk about the G-spot. He just tells these weird stories about women who basically masturbated by inserting things into their urethra,
mm-hmm.
which is anatomically way different if you know the anatomy. So then it got picked up by these, in the 60s, I've forgotten who wrote the book. Again, I'm showing my nominal aphasia or anomia. And to kind of touted the G-spot and cited Grafenberg as a source, but if they'd gone back and read his paper, they would have seen that he didn't talk about a G-spot.
Right.
Oh. And he was dead at the time, so he couldn't respond.
Now, the other thing that occurred to me was the people who believe in a G-spot not only could it be just suggestibility, but don't you think there's a certain amount of conditioning that goes along with that, too?
I mean, Absolutely.
If every time you have a sexual encounter, somebody touches your left elbow, eventually touching your left elbow would become very erotic, right?
Absolutely.
So, I mean,
absolutely.
It could be just merely explained on that basis.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. And what has puzzled me is nobody, you know, I wrote the paper and kind of figured that after I wrote the paper, there'd be a lot of people who had access to that kind of tissue who would just go and do the analysis. Because it's really a trivial, you know, pathological analysis to do. But no paper has come out that I've known, and I think I would know, you know, just really carefully looking at the anterior vaginal wall to see if you find clumps of nerve endings.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody's done that.
Yeah, interesting. But it's fascinating how you could do a very dry anatomical sort of paper and people respond to it so emotionally just because of the implications.
Yeah.
Like, how dare you tell me something I think is real is not real. I mean, that's basically...
Yeah.
Doesn't matter what you're talking about, if that's what you're saying. And you could just be dryly presenting evidence, they get very, very emotionally upset at being told that the emperor has
the
no
editor of the journal actually... At the end of the article in the original version that was submitted after revisions, I said something like, so the G-spot remains kind of a gynecological Loch Ness monster, much reported, much discussed, but never verified.
Right.
And the editor wrote back and said, you can't say Loch Ness monster, that's going to insult women, so change it to something less offensive. And I think I said UFO.
Right. Yes, you did. A gynecological UFO. That's
UFOs are less offensive than the Loch Ness monster.
Well, you know the term monster.
But I think that would have invited a lot of alternate definitions of what UFO stands for, which I won't go there. But
I've been there, but let's not.
We're actually running almost out of time. But so there's one other thing I wanted to talk to you about. It goes by very quickly. We'll definitely have to have you back on our show in the future.
I'd love to.
I noticed that you wrote a review of Steve Malloy's book Junk Science Judo. Now Steve Malloy was on our show a few months ago. And you know, it was, you know, one of our it was pleasant, but you know, there were some disagreements about some specific topics that we talked about, which is not typical for this show. And subsequent to his being on the show, there's been a lot of accusations about the credibility of his so-called skepticism. I actually had emailed Steve to get some comments on some of the things that we've been reading, and he basically said, I can't discuss any of this because there's pending litigation, or he's dealing with his lawyer. So I'm not asking you to make any specific statements that you would feel uncomfortable with about him, but you did write a review of his book, Junk Science Judo, which was published in The Skeptical Inquirer.
And
you were very critical of the quality of his skepticism. It was interesting getting your thoughts on that.
I was mostly critical of the quality of his statistical arguments. I mean, if you're going to write a book about, I mean, statistics is pretty tedious, but if you're going to write a book for the lay public, it's best to get the statistical facts right. I didn't really have much to criticize about the skeptical issues he took on. I think I probably agreed with almost all of them.
Right.
But when he just made some just basic errors in describing what statistics are, how they're done, that were, I thought, inexcusable.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. He was pretty dismissive of statistics in general, and I think you correctly pointed out it's just a tool. It's how you use them. It's not.
Yeah, and when he uses the term statistics in that book, and maybe on the show, but I didn't hear him, he really means correlations.
Right.
And so if he had used his word processor and just substituted correlational analysis or correlation for statistics, there'd be criticism, but there'd be less to criticize. So, you know, he doesn't understand or he doesn't care about the fact that, you know, if there's a correlation, you can't draw a causal inference. But when you do experiments, you can. And he lumps everything together in statistics as just correlations, and that was wrong.
Yeah, right.
And boy, was he PO'd about my review.
Was he?
Yeah, yeah. He actually his publisher wrote a response.
Go ahead. What was his response?
Well, the publisher wrote a response in the Skeptical Inquirer, like the next issue or so, and the response was basically, well, this is a book for the layperson, so it doesn't really matter.
I see.
He wasn't trying to teach statistics.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, we'll be discussing him again in the future. Again, I couldn't get a comment from him about that, but he's very, very controversial figure, very controversial.
Yeah, I can't imagine what kind of litigation he's involved in. Nothing in the book, at least in that book.
He's taking litigation against people who have slandered him, basically. So he's going after some of his critics for slander. Is the impression that I got, and he didn't want to discuss that. Because, I mean, there have been people who have been accusing him of essentially, and I'm not making these accusations, I'm just reporting what other people are saying, accusing him of basically being a shill for the tobacco industry, for the oil industry, and that he's using skepticism as a way of pushing a right-wing agenda. Those are the accusations that are being made against him. And
I certainly got the impression that he's fairly right wing. That you know, sometimes the right wing's right, and sometimes it's mostly sometimes it's not.
Right.
But I certainly agree with him and Penn and Teller that there's very little evidence that secondhand smoke is harmful. I mean, I think that I think cigarette smoking ought to be banned in public places just because it's really unpleasant.
Right, I agree.
And just like you ban people, you know, if you're in a bar and somebody spits wine on you. It's not particularly harmful, but I don't want people doing that to me.
Right.
So
right.
Stop it and make it illegal and go away. I do think he comes from a pretty right wing perspective. But I think the things that he said in the book were correct about the skeptical issues. Does secondhand smoke cause harm, et cetera, et cetera. But his description of statistics was just way off.
Right. Right. Well, again, the topics are interesting, and again, the where a specific claim falls on the political spectrum is irrelevant to whether or not it's true or not. The facts and evidence make it true or not true, and the quality of the arguments are raised. So, Terry, thank you so much for being on our show. It was a pleasure.
You're more than welcome.
I hope to have you on again in the future.
Love to.
Bob, Perry, thanks for joining me.
Sure.
Good to have you on. Until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is a production of the New England Skeptical Society. For information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.thenes.com. You can send us questions, comments, and suggestions to podcast@thenes.com. Theorem is performed by Kinetto and is used with permission.